Comfort Eating with Grace Dent is supported by Ocado. With more choice than any other supermarket, there's an Ocado just for you.
I'm Grace Dent, and this is Comfort Eating from The Guardian. A podcast where we pay homage to the lesser celebrated foods in life. Because even as a restaurant critic, I believe the food that matters most is often that snack you cobble together when you're curled up on the sofa. Each week, I ask my guest to lift the lid on what comfort foods have seen them through their lives. Because you can tell a lot about a person from what they eat behind closed doors. Hello, friends. Welcome to Comfort Eating. I'm just enjoying a lunch of buttered toast and fish paste. Yes, the one in the jar. Only God can judge me. Today, I am going to be chatting to a very, very talented man, the much adored screenwriter, Russell T. Davies. Russell must be nearing the status of national treasure, I feel. He's perhaps best known for his revival of Doctor Who for the BBC and his groundbreaking gay drama Queer as Folk and the absolute genius of Years and Years. But it may be his recent drama about AIDS, It's a Sin for Channel 4, that has seared his name into TV royalty. Russell is known for being a lovely man, but I know his life has been far from plain sailing. And I found an unexpected number of parallels with his life and mine as well. I can't wait to talk about that. We're going to be hanging out over video call today, and I am really looking forward to this. He's a bit of a living legend. Okay, right. Hang on a minute. Actually, this fish paste is pretty pungent. Thank God he's miles away. It smells like cat food, actually. Russell T. Davies, welcome to Comfort Eating.
Hello, Grace. Hello. Thank you for having me.
I've been looking forward to this so much. Oh. I feel like we know each other already. Don't be freaked out.
I know we should know each other. Well, we do now. Here we are.
We do now.
Comfort Eating together. Marvellous.
Are you in your writer's lair now? What's the view out the window? Where are you?
This is my little office where I sit and write, and in front of me is the whole of Swansea Bay, which is a huge bay, as you know. And it's sunny today. It's beautiful. I'm very lucky.
We'll start with your comfort food that you have asked to be prepared for me today.
Yes.
Now, this podcast, it's not really an interview so much just a chance for me to be very nosy.
And I like that. That's good.
It's just nosiness. So I have a bowl covered in tinfoil in front of me that's been prepared for me as per your strict instructions.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like a remote chef. I'm very intrigued. What am I going to be eating today? I literally have no idea.
Welcome, Grace, to the world of butter, pepper, rice. This is my signature dish, butter, pepper, rice. And do you know what? Let me tell you, because your producer talked me through this yesterday. We set all this up and I woke up this morning thinking, what a stupid thing I've done. Why have I said butter, pepper, rice? Until 2 minutes to podcast when I put it all together and I was going, oh my God, this is delicious.
So, you know, just for people that can't see the rice, it's a bowl of rice. That is all it is. It has no real colour to it. It's just long grain rice.
It should be Uncle Ben's. It should be so white it's bleached. And really, on it, Grace, it's an excuse to eat butter, isn't it? Mm. It's all about the butter. There happens to be rice in there. There's a bit of pepper just to give it a bit of whatever. Butter, pepper, rice.
Mm-mm. You know something, though? That is so comforting.
It's lovely, isn't it? Because look, we've all got a cupboard full. I've got a bit of pesto. I've got a tin of tomatoes. It's easy to jazz this up. Don't. That's what I'm saying. Don't have the rice with a bit of butter, with a lot of butter, and the pepper. Nicest food in the world. Gorgeous.
I just want to eat this whole roll.
It's just lovely, isn't it? It's surprisingly lovely.
Yeah, it's
so glad you think
it's satisfying. It's sating. How much butter is in there? Is it what I would call a wodge of butter?
It's a wodge.
Or
it's,
is it a slither of
it's,
butter?
Oh, no. There's no point to that. Does anyone... Who has a sliver of butter? What's the point? Butter wasn't made to have
weirdos.
Slivers. Weirdos. Yes.
And perverts.
No, a wodge. Not 50-50. That would be going too far, I've got to say. But, oh, yours looks nice. I can see yours now. That's very nice. It's like, oh, nice rice.
The thing with this is it's so Moorish that... Because it's got kind of a real... It's basically rice pudding. It's
you're
that
right.
kind
actually,
of...
yes, the sweetness comes out, doesn't it? You're right, actually. Yeah. Yes.
How did you come up with this?
It's midnight, you're hungry, what's in the cupboard? There it is. It's like it wasn't planned particularly. My favourite thing about it is that I haven't actually eaten it all that much over the years, but it made my husband laugh and laugh and laugh so much. When I unveiled the fact that last night I'd had butter pepper rice, that it just became one of our running jokes. And almost every night he'd say, oh, just let's have some butter pepper rice. Let's do that. The fact that I'd named it butter pepper rice, he loved.
You're back in Swansea, and I know that you spend time between there and Manchester.
Yes.
Do you write in both of the places, or is one a holiday home?
Oh, no. There are no holidays. And I've done that typical man's thing of I'm very lucky to have two houses. And I've done that thing of literally recreating, but my cutlery is the same. My crockery is the same. I walk in, it's the same mug. Look, here I am with a Pantone mug, the yellow Pantone mug. And it's the same. So you just, the same knives and forks. Everything feels the same.
Why do you do that?
It just feels comfortable. Well, everyone has a favourite mug, don't they? You have a favourite mug, and I love a Pantone mug. That's comfort food for me, drinking tea out of a Pantone mug. And it's always the yellow for me, the 1225 being my absolute favourite. It's got a number. Oh, my God.
It.
I'm just sounding nuts now. Come on this podcast and sound nuts.
What conditions do you need to be able to write well, apart from the tea in your special mug?
Well, just to be left alone, really. Simple as that. I'm getting worse as the years goes on. I now need days in which I've got nothing else to do. Mm. Now, if I've got a meeting at 11 o'clock, the day's spoilt. It's like I haven't got myself to myself. And I will have to make myself work on days like that. Whereas if I get up and the diary's completely blank, that's a perfect writing day. Actually, that's a day I'll probably then go and watch telly all day. And then the next day will be a perfect writing day because, of course, I'll do anything to put it off. But, yeah.
Do you get up incredibly early?
No. I'm happiest at night, really, until about 2 or 3. I love it then. Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
So really late on, 3 o'clock in the morning, do you think that's a good time to come out with a plot twist?
That's why at midnight you'll find me scavenging the cupboards of butter pepper rice.
I'm really interested in how much you actually love being alone because I was reading about you really wanted solitude even when you were little, even when you were just living with your family in a house. So
yes.
It's like you kind of loved time by yourself then.
It's true. Yes, I did.
Why was that?
I don't know. And you know, when I'm being a cheap psychologist, sometimes I go, oh, is that a gay thing? She didn't fit in. Mm. But it goes way back before that. It's that when I was in school, primary school and stuff like that, I used to walk home and I used to love it when no one walked home with me. Sometimes, you know, people catch up with you, hiya, and they walk along, and my literal reaction, like, oh, damn. Because I had stories going on in my head. They were Doctor Who stories then. I was thinking of these things and explosions and chases, not just Doctor Who, cartoons, all sorts of things. I used to draw all the time then, rather than write. Mm. So my head was just full of that, and I'd get really interrupted if someone came along. And like holidays, I'd think, oh, a week to myself, how lovely. Like a half term.
I really empathise with that.
Like,
I've always loved my own company. I like people. I like to have a laugh, but I like my own company. If somebody, exactly, half term for me was a lovely break from having to see everybody at school.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, really? Oh, my God, yes. Yes. Exactly that. And it's not like we're happy in our own company, like we're walking around going, ha-ha, I'm happy. Because actually, being in your own company means you're digging into yourself and usually digging up stuff you don't like and, you know, or having a tough time with yourself even. But it's good. It feels good. It feels strong. I love it. Yeah.
You were the youngest of three children with two older sisters.
Yeah.
Your mum, Barbara, and your dad, Vivian. So I kind of see you as the dreamy, creative kid. How did your family react to that? Were they understanding and supportive of, you know, being an artistic child?
Oh, they were lovely. I mean, if anything, they were an artsy family. They were languages. My family were language teachers, which is on the artsy side. And in fact, we've got a niece now, my lovely niece Ruth, who's a mathematician. And she's a puzzle to all of us. It's like, where the hell did you come from? It's like she's a genuine mystery to all of us. Maths. So they were lovely. It was a house full of books. And yeah, they just loved it. They were all for it. They didn't believe I could ever get a job out of it. It's like I started work behind when I got a job in my 20s and 30s. I got a job. First of all, I worked behind the scenes in television. We never told my father I did that. He never knew. He never knew I was a writer. Never. And sometimes I'd forget and I'd phone home in the day and I'd go, hello. And he'd say, where are you? I'd go, oh, I'm at home. And he'd go, what are you doing at home? I'd be like, oh, God, it's like a television day off now. It's like Granada allow all their staff to have Tuesdays off. And I just lie. And I mean, that lie went on for about 20 years. He died a couple of years ago. And so we just kept that lie going forever. And then so I'd get credits on television saying written by, well, he was blind, so he couldn't see the credits. But nonetheless, people would say, oh, Russell's, and he'd be like, when did you write that then? I go, oh, in my spare time. I kind of do that in my spare time. Because it's quite easy, television writing. It's just evenings, a little hobby. So artsy, but not artsy enough to say, go and be bohemian, you know.
I can't believe that you hid this from your father. Was your family dynamic like that when you were a child? Did everyone keep things from your father?
Oh, yes. It was always like, whenever something happens in the family, we go through the whole sort of domino procedure of like, who should we tell? Why should we tell her now? Should we not tell her? Should we do this? Why don't we tell her I was ill? We literally still go through it instead of telling everyone the truth. And we're a lovely family. There's no dark secret at the heart of the family. It's just some strange way we've been brought up. It's funny, we're making it sound like the family has terrible secrets. The irony is, it's not like we're hiding abuse or neglect or poverty. It's like we're literally lying about who took the car yesterday. And did you lock the door? And have you visited your nan? And have you booked that holiday? It's like, oh, don't tell him you booked the holiday. Don't say that, because he'll only fuss. And so I'll say I did it yesterday. It's like we live this. It's mad, isn't it?
So I was reading about how your dad was the chairman of Swansea Rugby Club.
Yes.
And I think that's such a defining thing in so many ways, because rugby's such a big part of the community.
Oh, my God, yes.
He must have been a bit of a local celebrity. I mean, if you went anywhere, everyone must have known you.
Yes, a bit of a local celebrity. He was also a great after-dinner speaker as well. He was paid to give speeches. He was hilarious. He'd work very hard on these speeches. So, yeah, and that rugby club was the centre of our lives when we were young. I mean, I hated it. I couldn't bear it. But it was where you went on a Saturday afternoon, and I just used to sit there on a Saturday afternoon dying to get home before Doctor Who was on, because it had a television in the corner. I remember watching Tom and Jerry on that television, but you could never guarantee that my dad would put down his pint in order to get home for Doctor Who, and it was a major tension, but it's fun. And now, of course, all the family funerals. When I die, do come to my wake, because it'll be in Swansea Rugby Club. That's where we have all our funerals and do's and everything. So now when I go back there, it's like the tolling of a bell.
Tell me about the rugby club when you were a little kid.
That rugby club was very, very special to my family, because both my parents' only children, they both went through the war. And actually, my father, I realised much later on in life, came back from the war shattered and head spinning with it. So he came home, and a lot of them all came home. So that rugby club came their whole lives. And I talk about Saturday nights, they'd all carry on drinking. They'd all pile back to our house when the pubs goes 11 o'clock, and they'd stay up drinking till 2 in the morning. And my memory is of sitting on the stairs, listening to them all drunk and singing and happy. It was a very, very happy bunch of people. To me, it was what I did love was the women, the rugby wives, Myra and Noir, all these fantastic, all in their glittery jumpers, all in their glory, all drinking gin and tonics and singing and laughing. Amazing, amazing. The men fantastic as well, but there was just a great big gay streak in it, even as a kid, that just responded to those glorious women and their loveliness.
I love that you say that when you die, you still want to have your wake there, which makes me think that they put on a good spread.
Oh, I don't think I have much choice. It's just what my family will do. If I ask for somewhere else, they'll just ignore me. It is like, it's your classic. It's a lovely old sausage rolls, chicken wings, that sort of stuff.
if there was like a big win or something and there was going to be those fantastic women in their sparkly jumpers putting on a buffet, what's on this table? You've got your plate, you walk up, what are you going to get?
Oh, I'll get the chicken wings and nowadays a chicken thigh, which is a much nicer thing, obviously, and a sausage roll. I love all that stuff. But actually, it's like, it was better than that, actually. I'm kind of lying, actually, because it was a bit more, there was that element of, when these women would have dudes, there was that element of potluck to it. And actually, these women were great cooks. They were properly great cooks. So there'd be casseroles and stews. And my mother was an extraordinary cook. She'd work all day. She was a teacher. She'd come home one night. She'd say, it's osso buco tonight. Osso buco? I mean, who has osso buco on a Tuesday night? That's the kind of chef she was. It's like she'd make, the only thing she ever made that failed was rum baba. She made her own rum babas and they were just awful. And that was, you know, she'd been to France. She traveled a bit. She was, you know, she was bigger than Swansea. My mother, bless her. She was an amazing cook. She would think nothing. She lived in the kitchen. She just stood there all day long and just potted, just cooked. The fridge was just jam packed all the time. She loved it. Everything she made tasted good. Coquille Saint-Jacques. She'd say, let's have Coquille Saint-Jacques. Just things like that. And that, so that's so ordinary fancy to me. I know those things are like,
so
like
fancy.
Ordinary food to me. That's like, oh, my mum's done that.
When you were 18, you got a place at Oxford.
I did,
to study English. So
yes.
That must have been like quite the transition from where you were to Oxford.
It was actually, yes. It was, yes, it takes you many years to think about that, really. And my parents are very proud, and because, you know, they were the first generation ever to go to university. They both went to Swansea University. So then the next generation, go to Oxford. It was huge to them.
Tell me about your first term at Oxford.
Well, it was like, in terms of like, you get there, and of course you're 18. It's 1981. There aren't like, what did you do for lunch, Grace? Before I kind of worked out the system that I didn't know where lunch was. And this is before Pret a Manger. Can you imagine a world in which there were no sandwich shops? And where do you eat and what do you do and where do you go? And I mean, there were cafes, but even then cafes were much more, they were a bit more restaurant-y. To go to a cafe, you'd sit down and have your cutlery. They weren't takeaway coffees like there are now. You wouldn't do that. It was all much more sit down. So I remember thinking, well, what do I actually do? And of course, I'd never had to feed myself. But my mother just had a fridge full of food. You just went to the fridge and there was ham and there was cheese and there was whatever and bread and you just ate.
So where did you go?
Well, my comfort food for that first term became Woolworths and just having a piece of that pork pie with egg in it. Gala, is that gala pie? Is that called gala pie? Which, let's face it, is a lovely food any day. I would have that if I was sitting having dinner in Buckingham Palace. I'd say, bring me a piece of pork pie.
Right. So I have equally fond memories of Woolworths, right? Who doesn't? Woolworths, yeah. A magical place.
Emporium.
You know? But I don't have any strong memories of them selling.
Oh.
Fresh-ish food.
Oh, there was a proper meat cabinet thing. Yes, you know, this wasn't pork pie wrapped up in a plastic thing. This was like, we'll cut a piece of pork pie for you.
Tell me about the Woolworths pork pie with egg in it. I want you to tell me how it tastes, how you serve it when you take it home. Do you have it with a condiment?
Oh, no, because it's kind of juicy enough. It's very juicy pork pie, that one. Good crust to it. And I like the jelly. People, you know, you meet sometimes people who leave the jelly behind. What kind of people are they? Fools. Proper pig. None of you, you know, it's that mechanical pork pie. It's not, you know, modern pork pies are kind of like, they're a bit greyer, like that's closer to the natural animal, stuff like that. Your Woolworths pork pie was just pink, bright pink with a lot. And if you were lucky, you got a slice with a bit of yolk in the egg. If you're unlucky, of course, you get the end of the egg, which was, what do you do, stand there and complain? I can't have the end of the egg, please? Just the one, give me some yellow? You can't do that.
Do you know, and in a lot of ways, isn't that like life?
Isn't it? Do you get the yellow or do you not? It's... And after about a term, I worked out where everyone was going. And you actually went to like the bar in the university where they did a very nice lasagna. So then I'd like 3 years of lasagnas for lunch.
When you were just 24... You moved to Manchester.
Yes.
To write on Prime Suspect. It blows my mind. Did you meet Helen Mirren?
It wasn't quite that easy. I went to do children's programs and it took me a long time to get into that Prime Suspect room. Chucklevision first? That was one of the first things I ever wrote.
And to be honest, whatever. So Helen Mirren, but the Chuckle Brothers.
To hell with that, exactly. And I probably get more repeat fees for that than anything I've ever done because chuckle is a universal language.
It feels like when you got to Manchester, you were just working and working and working and, you know, really, really exhausting yourself. Were you feeding yourself then? Did you learn where food came from? What did you eat when you were sitting at your desk?
Well, and because the hours were ferocious. I did join children's television, and one of the joys about children's television is it's very cheap, so you have to do everything. So you learn an awful lot, but you have to do everything. And my favourite thing to eat then, again, shops weren't open 24 hours then, even in a big city like Manchester, but they were like grocers in Rushome. I lived just behind Rushome, the Curry Mile. I still live there. So they'd get like corner shops that were grocers that would just sell tins of stuff. And my favourite thing to eat then, and again, like 10 o'clock at night, were tins of new potatoes, boiled, peeled new potatoes, which I can still taste now. I still think that's delicious. I love eating stuff from a tin. I love chickpeas as well, just to be a bit more healthy. I can to this day, I can still eat a tin of chickpeas in 30 seconds flat. I love chickpeas. Have you ever had potatoes from a tin?
I have had potatoes from a tin when I was a little girl. So they're in a very salty, briny water, aren't they?
And it's a very specific, they don't taste like any other form of potato. They taste tinny. They taste of the tin. And I love them. That and a fork, gone.
I think there's a specific type of person that does eat from the tin because I will eat from the tin. I can't open beans and take the beans to the microwave without taking a spoon and eating the first. But I know that that provokes a very strong reaction in several of my exes as they've been leaving.
Really? Were there not other reasons?
No. I like to think it was the beans. I'm going to go to Manchester, 1998. You're at a club called Cruise 101. Yeah. This is when you met your future husband, Andrew. Yeah. And I think it seems from what I'm saying, it became clear almost early on that he was going to be something serious.
It was, yes.
What was it about you two that suited each other?
Just can't tell. I wish I could tell you because I lived through it. But literally, I met him on the Saturday night and I went into work on the Monday to my lovely producer, Nicola, who I still work with, Nicola, who produced Queer as Folk with me. And I said, oh, I copped off someone really nice on Saturday night. And I said, I think he'll be around for years. Isn't that funny? I said it. Yeah. She's an absolute witness to the fact that I said that. And that wasn't like me at all. And before that, he's only, really, the only second boyfriend I ever had. I just didn't do boyfriends. I was so busy living on my own, I always think I didn't have room for a boyfriend. You know, you meet friends, you get this, you meet friends of yours, go, oh, I'll never get a boyfriend, I'll never get married. I've got no room for them in my life, my life's fine. And it's like someone comes along, suddenly everything changes and you've got all the room in the world for someone to fit in when they fit.
You love being on your own though, don't you?
But I love being with, and actually he bore the brunt of that for many years. He didn't actually move in with me until I moved to America in 2009. And then he decided to follow me out there because he wanted to be with me. And so that's when we moved in together. Then we moved back and he was very ill. He got cancer. So then we lived together. So up until that, we had about 9 years of me saying, or 10 years of me, no, 11 years of me saying, no, you're not living with me. And he'd come around. He'd come around in the night sometimes, not every night. We'd spend all weekend together. But, oh, my God, I defended my turf like crazy. Like crazy. But I don't know. How does that work? I do remember seeing him. This is the strangest thing to describe, but I honestly thought it. This isn't hindsight. I remember the time I remember looking across this club and seeing him. And the weird thing was, he'd lived there for 10 years. Canal Street's not that big. We must have been walking past each other 100 times on that street and never seen each other. He says he'd never seen me. I'd never seen him. Mm. And I saw him. And honest to God, my reaction was kind of like, I remember feeling like, oh, there he is. Like that. That's it. Yeah. I did. Oh, there he is. Weird, isn't it? How strange. And there he was, and he was, and he was lovely. Bless him.
Now, as you know, my podcast is supported by Ocado. Ocado can bring more of what matters to shoppers. Fantastic customer service, flexible delivery times, and most importantly, an unbeatable range. over this series, I'm going to be highlighting that by taking a peep at some Ocado customers' shopping lists. What can I tell about them from their trolley? Right, this time we have Bryony's shopping list. Let's take a look. Some definite Spanish flavours going on in this trolley. There's some Brindisi anchovies and their sardines and their pitted olives picante and some Chicos smoked almonds. I think it's tapas night round at Bryony's house. I wish I had an invite. Whatever your own trolley looks like, there's an Ocado just for you. Find out more about Ocado's unbeatable range and great service by visiting ocado.com. Your career hit the next level. You took over Doctor Who in 2005.
Yeah.
That had been your lifelong dream.
Yes.
Ever since you were walking to school.
Yeah.
Wishing that people wouldn't come and catch up and want to speak to you because you were thinking of Doctor Who plots.
Absolutely. Properly a lifelong dream, yeah.
The past decade, you've written endlessly programmes like Torchwood. Years and years, you've won multiple BAFTAs. You've been nominated for Emmys. And I have to assume that you are no longer at this point. By the time all this money's arrived, you are no longer surviving on tinned potatoes. What were you and Andrew eating together at that point?
Well, when we first got together, he was a nice cook. He'd do like a pork casserole or he'd do a rack of lamb and stuff like that. He was a nice, straightforward cook. So actually, I could relax a bit. I was like, oh, good. And we both loved a salad, actually. Do you know what? We do a lovely chunky salad. Do you know, like people slice tomatoes and cucumbers in little thin little bits. We have great big chunks in our salad.
Yeah.
And we had a nice time with that. And then, of course, he fell ill. He got cancer. He got brain cancer. And so suddenly Muggins here to do all the cooking. That was a major shock in my life. And I thought, well, I have to. I really have to. He's ill. No kidding about. And so I became quite a good cook. I'm not calling myself a good cook, but actually I like my food. I think I basically heat things up. I don't do those magic. I won't do a gravy. I won't do a sauce. That's just too much hard work. But I do heat things up nicely. Timing, Grace. It's all about the timing. It's I can time things to death.
So when you're in LA, yes, Andrew becomes ill, and you find out that he has a brain tumor. The pair of you immediately move home and you do. You stop work and care for him. Like yes. I've been in a similar situation with my mother.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's I'm very interested in this idea of suddenly you go back and when you're caring for someone, what you're cooking at that time, you know, because you must have been doing all of the cooking then. Did you get to that point where you kind of have a list of things that you know that person responds to and you keep just cooking them all the time?
Yes, I suppose what I did. For a start, we basically thought, let's make your food healthy. But initially he only had about 18 months to live. He ended up living for 8 years. Not down to my cooking, but you never know. It could have been me. And so he was never going to go on like a macro diet. You know, people are lining up to say, just live off flaxseed and onion peel and then you'll save your life. And it's like, you know, he wants to be happy. Let's have food that makes you happy. So we're not banning chocolate. We're not doing that. It's that. But I will be healthy. So it's like, so I used to cook these meals of a lot of fish. And tons of fish, basically 8 vegetables on your plate every night. I love that. And I still cook that now to this day, now that he's gone. I'm like a walking vegetable. I just do it automatically. My timings are like so, I go shopping, I just know where everything is. I know the timings, like 12 minutes for the carrots, 9 minutes for the cauliflower, 8 minutes for this, blah, 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 all the way down, 3 minutes for the peas. So they were incredibly healthy meals and very tasty, may I say, and also not ruined by having gravy slathered all over it. It's just...
I don't think that people talk about that period of having to care for someone, you know, near the end. We don't really talk about it, that space, because I couldn't really work during that time. Could you work? Were you writing a script here and there?
No, I had about 2 or 3 years off, and then it became clear he was not recovering, but he was all right. He was more, he was stable, he was fine. He wasn't fine, but he was okay. There was a chance he could have survived. There was a chance for a few years that he got through it. So that's when I got back to work. But actually, the reason why I'm talking about the eight vegetables a night is that I loved it. And I loved timing that stuff. And yeah, it's knackering. And yes, it's strange. But actually, I love him. And so it's very, everyone was kind of amazed that I gave up work and became a cook and things like that. If anyone expected me to get staffing, it was then. But I was like, this is easy. I actually found it easy. And I'm very much aware you can be a carer. My God, you can be a carer for 20 years and really suffer. And also financially, I was okay. I always saved and saved and saved for a rainy day. And then one day it rained. And so I could take those 2 or 3 years off. I could have taken more years off. It's weird that, but I was always ready for some sort of emergency or disaster. So all that cooking, I loved it. That's why literally 30 minutes to prepare that evening meal, bang, 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 like a automaton, but loving it, getting all ready, preparing the breakfast at the same, oats, overnight oats for breakfast every day with fruits, which I still have now. I love those oats. You see, I wouldn't swap that for the world. So it was very, very tasty stuff, but an honour, really, an honour to be cooking it, to be doing that. It was never a hard job. Sometimes friends would say, oh, you know, do you want me to come in and cook a meal for you? Oh, no way. No way. Absolutely. I knew exactly what I did. And he loved it. He was very ill towards the end. One of the last sentences he ever said to me was, I was feeding him the old overnight oats that he loved so much. And he just said, it's delicious. He could hardly talk. And he just went, it's delicious. That was the last but one sentence he ever said to me, I think. So that was like, wow. That's nice. It was delicious. It still is. So, yeah, bless him.
It's so strange because when I think about the last few months I had with my mum, she died on February the 1st. And I really think about, yes, it was awful, but yes, I was happy.
Yes, absolutely. I was happy and I was there. It's an honour, isn't it? It's the greatest act of love you'll ever go through, possibly. It's like, I didn't realise it was that recent. You must be still reeling. Gosh, darling.
Well, you know, I mean, I was going to ask you about that. How quickly did you start writing again? Because I started working immediately.
I had to. I was in the middle of years and years. I think the funeral finished and I kind of went home and started. I was in the middle of a show, that Years and Years thing on BBC One, and I'd written 5 episodes of 6 and they were about to start filming. So I was kind of glad in a way, actually, because it's not like, I mean, if you don't write, going to write sounds like a hardship, or it sounds like going back to work in a factory or something. If you do write, you know that actually it's part of you. So it's not separate from the grief you've just been through. It's part of you. It's a way of expressing yourself. So I was more than happy to go back to work and I haven't really stopped since, to be honest. So it's fine. And my mum died in like 2001, 20 years since my mum died. I don't think I've stopped work since then.
I love that you just said to me that Years and Years thing that was on BBC One, as if I maybe wouldn't have heard of it. And I think it's probably one of the most exquisite, multi-layered pieces of drama about a family ever seen. I mean, absolutely incredible. I think that you do touch on all those themes there. I mean, it's interesting that you were going through that grief, but then also writing about, you know, these very big themes around death and loss and fractures in families and the end of the world.
And a family that comes together and has a party and has a meal every year. Every episode they get together. There's sometimes a wedding. Sometimes it's always Gran's birthday or they have a barbecue or something. It's all about the family and the food, actually. That it's all happening there.
What did you do for Andrew's wake if you had always been around food? Did you have specific things? Or?
Oh, no, it was a pub that did nice food. Very, very, it was your posh chicken wing. It wasn't a deep fried chicken wing. It was just nice, really nice though. And it was like, yes, I ordered a lot and a lot of people came. And then we all went back to my house where my sister had cooked like 1 million meatballs. She's great, my sister. She's a brilliant cook and she cooks. Every time she cooks meatballs, she puts something different in. She goes, don't ask me the recipe. She's like that. I just shove in whatever's there. And they're always different every time. She's like that. Different every time. And it is slightly different every time. So a vast vat of meatballs was perfect that night. Our family and Andrew's family all together just devouring them. Lovely.
You seem like you're in a really good place at the moment.
Yes, I am. Yes, to be honest. It's like, I'm sad that he's gone, but I'm kind of just kind of used to that. I'm eternally sad that he's gone. That doesn't get any better. But that's fine. That's fine. I like missing him, you know? It's funny because, like, you know, all couples are couples and they are together. But when he was ill for the last 8 years, we spent every second of every day together. So I'm very much aware that I walk along. I still walk to the same shops. I still go to the same places. So I can literally, he used to have a walking stick because he was slightly disabled after one of the operations. So his little walking stick used to go click, click, click. I used to say, here he comes, click, click, click. And it's like that click, click, click still following me. I can still hear it. So I quite like that. Sometimes I think you should stop thinking like that and move on. But I'm fine. It's like work is good. So, yeah.
Do you think that experience flavoured when you were writing those scenes in It's a Sin? Because, you know, I found that so moving. You know, obviously I knew what I was signing up for when I started watching It's a Sin, you know, and I'm so, so glad that you've covered this space in history and, you know, brought it to the forefront.
Thank you.
Until Colin.
Oh, Colin.
And I found Colin. That scene of him, when he'd lost dignity, I think that I found that it really, really cut me. I thought, to write this, you have to have seen it, you know?
Sometimes I think I'm a monster, but that is Andrew's death. That was like the staring into space and just gone. He was just gone. Like I say, there were a couple of last sentences. And then there were another 10 days after that of just, you know, if only his eyes had been closed, but they weren't. They just stayed open, staring. And who knows what he was thinking? I kept talking. My sister was there. When he died, I was holding one hand. She was holding the other. So I'm so glad she was there. Bless her. And my other sister would have been. And it's funny. Sometimes you write things that you've been through and you put them on page and you think, am I some sort of monster? Shouldn't I keep that private? But then you think, but I love Colin. I love Colin. I created Colin and I want to write his death to be as powerful and as... And Colin is real people. God, you've had those friends who died from that illness, from any illness, too young. We've all had that. Everyone's had that loss somehow. So you have to do them justice. So in order to do them justice, you have to use that stuff. You have to dig it up and be raw and shove it in there because it's real. Then it works. And that worked. That unashamedly worked. So, yeah, I was also sort of thinking, gosh, would his family be upset that I used the same eye thing, the same... I don't think I even told the actor that was lovely Callum, that was based on Andrew's death. But yes, it's not like I'm talking like there's a choice, but in the end it's me sitting at this desk at 2 a.m. with some butter pepper rice, thinking, yes, you're not even choosing to put that on the page. I mean, that's why I write, is that I have those things in my head, and so I put them on the page. You know that. It's just that you can't censor yourself. You can't tidy it up. Yeah.
Thank you for talking to me about this. We didn't have to go so deep about all this.
I know,
I think it's because I'm going through it as well at the same time. And it's...
I mean, you are talking, you've got people to talk to about it and stuff.
I mean,
I don't really.
I mean, that's exactly it. I'm absolutely surrounded by people that I can talk to about it. But why do that when you can just keep on signing book deals and just throwing yourselves into those things? Is that not the healthy way to deal with things?
Exactly.
You know, you have to keep going. You have to just keep going.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and everyone does. That's the other thing you realise, is that actually no one stops. No, really. Not really. Everyone out there. Everyone you ever pass on the street has lost someone. And they just eventually... quickly go back to work. Most people have to go to work on the Monday morning. Let's be honest, we can choose. You know, we can choose when to sign our deals and stuff like that. Everyone else, it's like, we'll have 2 days off for the funeral and then back you come, love. And we do. You just do.
Russell, thank you for bringing butter pepper rice into my life.
Thank you for not laughing me off the podcast.
And thank you so much for comfort eating with me.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you. That's a really different way of looking at your life. And I've thought about things that... Because I thought of me arriving in Manchester 24 and having so much work that I just eat potatoes out the tin is like, wow. I've not done badly. I've done all right.
It's a powerfully erotic image.
I knew we'd get there in the end. You've been fighting it off.
I'm only flesh and blood. This episode of Comfort Eating was produced by Gabriella Jones. The series producer is Leah Green, and the executive producer is Kathy Drysdale. Music and sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. If you like this podcast, please leave us a rating and a review. You can subscribe wherever you're listening now so you never miss an episode. Thank you for listening.
Thank you to Ocado for supporting Comfort Eating with Grace Dent.